Hello.
Hello and welcome to our not quite regular Monday show live from our orbital moon base.
Yems.
It's the Scrump and Evelyn show.
Yeah, we do need some sort of jingle, probably.
We do require some kind of jingle, but hello.
Hello, all my little chuddies. How are we doing this evening?
Yes, hello to all the small friends in our computer. How do you fit in there?
there's that many people waiting already. We must be some sort of hot commodity these days, despite our attempts to be exactly not that.
Yes. Well, we're the back end's just catching up, but this is why we allow the back end to catch up, because man, YouTube is strange tech wise sometimes. Well, the back end's just catching up.
I will say, before we go further, the weather has been cold and miserable,
and it's trying to
not succeeding.
The weather has been cold. See that? We'll finish this. We'll look at the weather and be like, set down.
Yes, we are still monetized somehow, and we actually have a few donations.
Shire Strike has sent us £2. All enemies bad, all friends good. Pretty much. He sent us another £5 as well. Beer money, you must buy the finest beer with this. Of course, he keeps these dark miles. What else? Greater Manchester non-friend unit will come if you don't buy beer with it. Okay. Oh, that's a threat I can live up to. Ross McIlvenny sent some tenor and says nothing ever happened. Very true. Lamented Guy has sent us some sort of strange hippo character spending in a chair, which I'm deeply entertained by. And Shire Strike has also sent us another £20. Have some Kenny's friends this once for four market farmers rescue piece. Thank you for your generosity before we've even started the stream. I suppose that now people send a little bit of super chat to end now, and everyone else can just go home. We're not going to do that. So what I will say is that if you don't want to give us monies via YouTube, you can also do it via the call. Or you can subscribe to the Substack, where there isn't much stuff at the moment. There's an alternative way of getting more streams when Substack subscribes.
I just upload stuff again. And there's going to be a bit of a mass upload on the Substack. So all of these podcasts that aren't there will be there.
I apologise in advance for anyone's feed that gets bombarded for an afternoon of like 7 or 8 streams all going at once.
But we've had a little bit of a back end trouble with the.
Substack has done a fart.
Yeah, Substack has done a fart.
We've had a little bit of trouble with the. We're saying we have an echo.
Oh dear.
Oh, have you been playing the stream audio back through? Oh, he's made such a rookie error.
Oh no, it's echoing. God damn it.
That's what I'm saying, because it's been playing the live stream back through.
Oh,
you've
God
had that
it.
Tab open with audio on it.
I didn't. I actually muted that audio. Apologies. I had the tab open with audio muted. It seems to have re-enabled my audio. But
you trusted the computer, you silly man.
Okay. Sorry about that. We've sorted the echo. Multiple echoes. We've sorted it.
Infinite Evelyn. God, what a problem that would be.
My apologies, guys. We've sorted that. That's so annoying.
I will not apologize for that because it's not my fault. But I will apologize on its behalf.
Apologies about that. Yeah, no, I actually mute Chrome as an. You know, the whole mute the tab, mute the whatever it's called. I do that all the time on the stream. This is the first time it's failed me, so apologies for that, guys. But no, we're not gonna restart this. Bring back the echo.
Oh no.
All we've done really is say thank you to people who've donated, and yes.
Yeah, sorry that we've been extremely echoey for the last 2 minutes. I think off the back of that, we should probably get moving.
Yes, thanks for the schizophrenia simulator. No, we won't be doing it from the top, don't worry, guys. And apologies to people, we've run off with that infinite echo. We don't usually have the boomer audio.
But there's, we've not maybe got as intense a structure or sort of idea as maybe we normally would with some of our streams this evening. I also just noticed that the lower third is the wrong title as well. We've still got how we knew Trump would win.
Oh no, we've got all the boomer stuff going
on.
Actually,
they came up 10 minutes ago, Richard. This was all right. Oh no.
Oh no, now we can fix stuff on the fly here.
There's serious QC errors going
on. Yeah, there's a few QC errors. It's really just kind of a right-left dichotomy stream.
Well, sort of, but to us, what we find more interesting, and I suppose what we've kind of been talking about, it's only somewhat recently, and I've been mentioning it because it's been part of some of the things we've talked about is the way in which certain issues are culturally or politically left or right coded. And this sort of, in a sense, means that either being part of the right or being part of the left, it's you've not got the full toolkit. You've got no idea really how to actually achieve gaining power, maintaining power, and then solving the problem of succession after such, because you don't have the full toolkit. Instead, what you've got is a subset of issues that might even actually directly contradict each other, and therefore leave you sort of engaging in conversation and debate and the marketplace of ideas, as opposed to actually sort of thoroughly watering your ideas down into action.
Well, what we want to do, and I'll get the
Democrats are the real racists.
No, goddammit, we are.
We'll get the Murdoch clip out of the way quickly. But I've just got a quick intro here, and what we're talking about here is the fact that there are a lot of ideas shunted between what is the left and right divide, and our theory and what we think, and what I think, is that the splitting of previously foundational political ideas between the left and right has been engineered to give both sides an incomplete toolkit and saddles them with an eclectic mix of disparate, contradictory ideas. Neither side is capable of analysis that reflects reality. The most important firewall between left and right is the presence of revolutionary ideas, power politics, and the recognition of class-based in-group preference present on the left, but that cannot be present on the quote-unquote right.
Yes. We forsake the principles of heritage or keeping things in an in-group so that we can belittle the leftists for being nepotistic.
Yes.
We deny the importance of loyalty to a sort of regime or an institution because we would rather turn around and go, oh, well, that's stultified and conservative. It's not modern thinking.
No, and I hopefully, it was difficult to entitle this because I don't want to just create a long, waffly title about the right-left dialectic and, you know, the split and the dipoles and two-party politics. It's not about that. It's not about decrying two-party politics. It's not about, decrying the uniparty. It's really about the utility of how ideas are framed.
Yes.
We're not engaging, as we usually do, we're not engaging with this earnestly and honestly. We're not trying to tell you, oh, don't, you know, we need a third party. That's not what we're saying here.
Are you not considering the fact that that would be the thing that, you know, this changes everything?
This changes everything. No, it's...
Oh, I might start stealing that one. That one's pretty good. I do like a, this changes everything. We're at breaking point. This changes everything.
This changes everything.
Everything. Except that one thing that doesn't change.
Except that one thing that doesn't change, yes. See, but we'll go through, because we're going to go through these, and these are equivalences, as we've shown.
Yes.
If you go across column-wise, these two, you know, they're supposed to be kind of opposites of each other. And when you get the political soup, this is what we consider kind of the current shorthand state of the, at least stated priorities and, you know, after priorities of the left-right split as it's framed now in the West. This is very specific to, I'd say, the Anglosphere, Germany, the EU. It's very specific to, quote-unquote, the cultural West.
Yes.
This doesn't work in certain other places.
No,
there are exceptions to this, but this, as far as American and British politics go, as we get the backwash from it, and Australian and New Zealand and a lot of European politics go, this is broadly the way things have shaped out.
And I think to suggest where this fits all into the puzzle of what we have otherwise looked at, that we have talked about the clown show and the elements of kayfabe and that you have faces and heels, that diametrically opposed sort of stage show is what allows them to create this sort of state of play, and that the playing field is these subset of ideas, and if you're on the right, you've got to use these ones, and if you're on the left, you've got to use these ones, because you've got to argue like a good rightist or a good leftist.
The big two here, I would say, at the moment, when we can just highlight a few of these.
Mm.
On the left, you see the framing of race and identity, but it is in the context of the redistribution of wealth and the equity, equity and protected groups.
Mm.
What happens is you have this acknowledgement of racial and identitarian reality that is then stapled to the utopian vision of equity.
But in that same vein as well, though, it's also
yes,
a understanding, at least from the leftist perspective, that it's zero sum.
Yes.
That in striving for equity, they will actually tarnish the principle of equality, which really is the right-wing problem nowadays, is that we've got to ensure proper equality because equity is the real problem. And you end up with this, these sort of two people talking about two issues that actually in no tangible way matter to us.
Well, I'll take you through... We'll go through these in order. We have incrementalism and continuity and revolution and reshaping, which are the two visions that are supposed to be what separate the right and left.
Yes.
And what you've put in the document, what I agree with, is that the left has a Schmittian framing and the right has a non-Schmittian framing to the implementation of politics.
Yes.
In the view of the quote-unquote mainstream right, it's a matter of continuity, of incremental change.
Doing as it's always been done before.
Doing as it's always been done, and, you know, the left are just misguided.
Yes, they don't understand the value and the tradition of the process.
No, which is where we'll talk about free speech later and how that is one of the telltale issues that, in our view, cross the aisle issue-wise.
But it's that general principle, the fact that thinking about completely restructuring society from the top down, which really is politics incarnate, left yes. or right, has now become something that we blame leftism for. I mean, I would almost go so far as to say the fact that if you were to ask someone about, say, the philanthropist kind of characters involved in COVID, like a Bill Gates, they'd assume that they're a leftist. But really, being that much of an elitist and organising so much of society from the top down by the methods they do really isn't strictly ideological.
No.
And if anything, is really closer to the sort of thinking that we are used to with elite theory.
Yes.
Even though elite theory and its more classical interpretation was really more of a sort of right interpreted point. And it's only when you've got sort of he's a big fan of, is it Althusser?
Yes.
He does a lot of it. We know Burnham does it too, but he at the time is this sort of post-Marxist character. The general point is that revolution has become the remit of the left. And because the right has become conservative in that big C literal form of trying to conserve what already exists.
Yes.
If you're trying to conserve the big progressive machine, then you're not really a rightist anymore.
No.
Because you've denied the fact that you need a revolution to get rid of that machine.
Well, it's also the fact that you have this supposed revolutionary energy on the left that, again, is stapled to this mass of identities.
Mm.
It is identities politics, almost. It is not identity politics,
yes.
which is very different. And that's why when you see it, you know, cross over onto the right, in quotes, when it talks about the rights of the individual, which is something that the post-war right has become incredibly bogged down by.
Yes.
Because it does not understand, or it pretends to not understand how groups work.
The rights of the individual yes. come from the group that precedes it.
Yes, and that's where really this kind of left-right, we taught them wrong as a joke stuff comes from.
This is, of course, why the Nazis were leftist.
Yes.
They believed in social programs. They believed in revolutions. They had an understanding and a project for the redistribution of wealth for their own benefits.
Yes.
So that obviously means that they are leftist socialists and not bold, you know, confident, individualist right-wingers like us.
It's where people end up in tying themselves in knots like
yes.
that. This is the arbitrary columnizing of a whole bunch of political ideas that have been all over the political map previously.
Mm.
You have, in the 19th century, a lot more talk of co-ops and voluntarism and almost the idea of effectively what were like right-wing communes.
Like a mutualism sort
yes,
of idea.
Like a mutualism idea, the protection of the land, things like that. And all of these things don't make sense in a historical political context. If you look further back, if you look back into antiquity, and politics as it stands in the classical sense.
Yes, even the notion that land was for sale in a market, for example, wasn't actually the principle really being dealt with at the time, even though when we look back through classical economics, that's the way we were told about it.
Well,
whereas
yeah.
it was much more a relation between, as you say, cooperatives, guilds, groups with different incentives that had political machinations of their own, chopping and changing land around for political purposes, not for economic purposes.
Well, as I've made a distinction before, a lot of the policies on the right are what would be considered peacetime policy,
yes,
and peacetime thinking. And a lot of the thinking on the left is what would be considered wartime thinking or conflict thinking, which is, again, if you see the way the two are used politically, what happens is, if you, with these first two, incrementalism is the right sits there and does nothing politically.
Hmm.
The left moved the program forward, and then the right comes in and refines it because they have the idea of incrementalism and continuity built into them. This is what helps the ratchet turn.
Yes, and also because, in an inverse sense, the interpretation we take on leftist history,
yes,
is one that's underwritten with liberal priors. They talk about the long march to the institutions.
Yes.
And that's why we now believe in incrementalism, because we believe they engaged in incrementalism, when all of that's not true whatsoever. Leftist bodies, progressive bodies, turned up with lots of money, raw power, legal support, and smashed centuries-old traditions in the matter of days, in the matter of weeks. So how are we, as people who want to return to those traditions, supposed to vote them back in or get them in via the process? So we end up wrapped up in this whole sort of giant lie, essentially.
Yes. A lot of the policy on the right, in quotes, seems to also be about bad jacketing order.
Mm.
You have this dipole between, you know, social responsibility and social order, and the two are seen as diametrically opposed.
Mm.
And the left is the people who will talk about social planning and social issues, whereas the right will not.
Yes.
They will simply talk about the security state, and their answer to all of the social questions would seem to be the security state.
I think almost you could go even one further with that. The right perspective on that is procedure.
Yes.
The leftist perspective is prevention.
Yes. I was about to say yes. So you end up with this idea that only leftists can engage in social engineering,
mm,
and only people on the right can engage in, say, security bolstering. But
yes,
the two, and the compromise is that we end up with a bigger security state and a bigger social services. And if you look at the compromise between these two, the compromise between the sovereign individual and race and identity is that we are all atomized, but we are all part of a great mass.
Yes.
They all serve the revolution of mass and scale. Compromise with free market economics and the redistribution of wealth is that you have the public-private partnership.
Yes.
That is where those two reach together. All of these dipoles are problems in search of a direct centrist managerial solution, where between merit and equal protection, equity and protected groups, you have things like the Equality Act.
Yes.
That is supposed to be what bridges this gap. And all we see,
which is, in a sense, just a make-work scheme for an infinite army of lawyers that, yes, engage in arbitration all day.
Yes.
And as you go further on there, the idea of free speech against the enforcement of social norms, that one I think's a proper double whammy.
Yes.
Because what you're saying as a rightist is that I respect the rights of my enemies to denigrate my traditions and heritage to no end.
Yes.
And what the leftist says is, you will fucking shut up.
Well, we'll talk about this later, but there's a switch here. It used to be that the enforcement of social norms was a right-coded idea.
Yes.
But now the enforcement of social norms, i.e. cancel,
is totalitarianism.
Yes. And so you end up with a right that has this idea of law and order, but not the enforcement of social norms.
And the idea that social norms come from the bottom up. That it's grassroots, it's the people that set cultural standards,
yes,
not the fact that they come from top down on a whim, and fundamentally have nothing to do with ideas or morality, but more so to do with direct and tangible political goals.
Checking here. We've got a couple more donations here. Thank you to Sheer Strike again. Thanks again to Trump for helping me with my video. It's a pleasure. I didn't really do too much, but thank you. Yes, thank you for the $10 there. Thunderstorm, my blue Skinner box has a blue light, but that red Skinner box has a red light. Both say I can't love myself and my own people, but it's a choice, not a false dichotomy. Yes. That is kind of what we're getting at here.
And then the last one we've got in the list here is one that I suppose we've kind of not necessarily done to death, but has very much been of recent conversation.
Well, this has come to sharp relief in that the newest addition to the foundational elements of the right supposedly is Zionism, whereas this is not historically something that has existed in traditionalist thinking well, obviously pre-World War II, because Israel as a state, you know, didn't exist.
No.
For most of human history.
What I find as well, though, and I think this is maybe a more specific conversation that might be worth having at another time, is that this notion of Zionism comes with a version of nationalism that's meant to be egalitarian and equal. I've always referred to it as sort of international nationalism, that all peoples have the right to a nation for all of their peoples. But fundamentally, that can't work. It's the sort of Hobbes problem and Leviathan extended not to peoples but to nation states. And at some point, you are going to have the sort of war against of all against all in a nation state sense. So you can't have nations for people, for every people, and that sort of self-determination idea that was brought forth in post-World War I and World War II. It's just not possible. You can't have all nations being equal to one another. And that's fundamentally something I would say anti-imperialism from the other end recognises, is that these nations aren't equal to one another. One is subjected to the other, and we wish to no longer have that.
Yes, and you can't... There's a whole soup of ideas that are not allowable, and that you breach this firewall, this arbitrary firewall, you get chinned for it, as you say. We have constantly been accused of leftist thought.
Yes.
Because we have a complete picture of a political system. We have a complete set of ideas, and having a complete set of ideas is not possible if you are on the modern centre-left, in quotes, or centre-right, and that is deliberate.
Yes, and I think people don't quite understand how much cultural momentum there is behind some of these stereotypes. I mean, it's something I put in the notes here. If you speak to an army or someone who is not initiated in what we do about Israel, about the influence that Jewish lobby groups have in Britain or France or Germany or whatever else, you will be looked at as if you are a bleeding heart liberal that has some, you know, moral crusade to engage in for the Palestinian people. Because that is for the best part of what, like a decade and a half, nearly two decades, those people have been painted as, unless you're actually going to put an SS hat on and the armband and the marching gear and all that, no one realises that what you're doing is critiquing Israel from the right.
Yes, it's very difficult because of this continuity and because of this setup. I'd say post-1945, yes, but really post-1990, post-Cold War, you see this set in very heavily.
They think you're critiquing Israel for the sake of the world, not critiquing Israel for the sake of your own people.
We'll probably return to this because we'll reference this a few times, but there are norms that exist, and this is the important part, above party politics.
Yes.
What is removed from the debate in all of this is something as fundamental as the security state in its existence. Should the security state, as developed post-World War II, because it didn't exist before World War II, should it exist? And the answer to that is yes in both cases. Nobody would, apart from us in many ways, would question the nature of state secrets.
Yes.
The nature of, you know, the public-private partnership again.
Having a body like the OSS or the FBI or the CIA, which operates purely on the exception and above the law.
Yes, and that exists purely, completely outside of what we've seen previously, apart from things like palace guards.
It is
very different than the way we've seen security enforced in the past. Of course, endless war. The classic example I use for this is Bush to Obama.
Can you not really say Bush to Clinton, to Bush, to Obama, to Trump, to Biden.
That's one handover of power, but I think the hope and change nature of the Obama campaign and the drone strike reality is one of the clearest indications that there is a permanent agenda that moves above these.
Mm.
And this really, all these things are the most important aspects of the permanent agenda, of the things that are not questionable in normal, quote-unquote, normal politics.
Yes, and you've also mentioned here civil rights, which actually becomes one of the, I think, current sticking points, really, is that certain elements of the, quote-unquote, woke left have gone to the level of essentially denying civil rights for their own benefit because they want black-only spaces. And this is where they are told by their own little centre-left group that that's where you've gone wrong. You can't do that. Of course, we get the same on the right. If you try and run a party in Britain purely for white people, the Conservative Party will turn around and go, under the Equality Act, which we instituted, you know, you can't do that. That's illegal.
Thank you for the £50 there, Ross McEvenley. What is that? I cannot speak right now. My mouth is not making
McElvenny,
that.
I think.
McElvenny, okay. My voice would not make that noise. Have some more on me. I'm expecting the UK to freeze my bank account at some point. So here, love from Russia. Thank you very much. I've had a few people from the Eastern Bloc, let's say, who watch our show. So we have something in Uzbekistan, apparently, as well. Mm. So hello to Uzbekistan.
But I also think on a certain level, this sort of civil rights central kind of pole to both left and right thinking or ideas that sort of go hand in hand across the aisles, that's there not just for moral questions or questions of ethnicity. It's there because it's ultimately something that helps commercialism and managerialism work better if you see all people as one and the same.
Yes.
It's easier to categorise a people, as you say, that are black, white, yellow, brown, you know, pink or whatever else. But if they're all individual citizens, all guaranteed the same stuff, then you can, in a sense, treat them all the same.
This, yes, you can create homo economicus. Civil rights really is the part of the march in earnest to turn people into interchangeable economic units.
Mm.
And again, what we also see is that all anti-Semitism is acceptable. We saw it unacceptable. We saw it in the Labour Party.
Anti-Semitism against Jews of all races,
yes,
all colours, all faiths.
But we do not see, it's one of the things we don't see questioned and never see questioned. There's never a question whether anti-Semitism is genuine.
Mm.
Whereas if you look at the right-left divide now with the woke, in quotes, a distinction is made between woke racism and genuine racism.
Yes.
And the concession to genuine racism in the civil rights framework is what's being argued. We are outside of that. We are outside of the frame, and therefore we get battered for it, basically. Something came out today about, you know, the racism against Kemi.
Olukemi.
Yes, the new Arsenal defender.
Yeah.
but again, they seem to pick out genuine, in quotes, sexism, racism, homophobia. Another big tense pole of this is democracy and commitment to the process.
I would be tempted to replace that. I do understand what you're saying there. But even more generally, the sentiment of anti-dictatorship.
Yes.
That even the leftist revolutionaries that are on the far end of Trotsky or whatever else, a lot of them still fundamentally engage in thinking that is democratic, it's consensus-based. The old world idea of a unelected great man that just sort of politically rules by his own individual will almost as he pleases with very little to no accountability, that's just not acceptable in any realms of politics nowadays.
Well, ultimately, democracy and commitment to the process are the veil put over the consensus rule of the elite class.
Yes.
The elite class are ballooned in size because of the revolution of mass and scale and post-war. They are a big group of people that move quite slowly. They have disparate interests that are often quite petty, but they, as we've talked about before, they agree where their power interests as a class align. And class analysis is one of the big things you're not allowed to do on the right.
No.
Class analysis from the right is considered like a nonsense. Like, what are you talking about?
You're a socialist?
Yeah, but the only people who've really done it are people like Samuel T. Francis, as we'll quote later. The things that exist above this dipole is neutral institutions of state, such as the NHS, the IRS, etc., and the neutral experts and the science.
The fact that human knowledge as it stands can be stripped of all political values.
Yes. It's the objective things we agree that we need, and then the objective things we agree that we know.
Mm.
And those two things together as a settled set of ideas are what make change, in a revolutionary rightward sense, impossible.
Yes, because we would want a world without an NHS, yes, without an HMRC, without a state school structure. Even
something as radical as like the state sponsoring of science. The state sponsoring of quote-unquote science has been disastrous. I'll be releasing something about that eventually. But the revolution of mass and scale in quote-unquote science has been completely destructive to human knowledge. And most people would look at you like you were completely insane if you said, yes, we'd like to bring back proper patronage, but the idea that a giant managerial government should quote-unquote fund science is insane.
Yes, or I think even something more on more general in terms of like the principle of education itself,
yes,
or the notion of educating a populace. These are things that we completely deny, but you could be, you know, from Navarra Media, or you could be from... I would even try and pick something that I would quote-unquote call far-right, but there really isn't much of that around nowadays.
Well, there's also a sense of a moral equivalency between left and right in different ways. Mm. There's this idea that the right is pragmatic, useful, but, you know, nasty and impersonal, and the left is well-intentioned but misguided.
Yes.
Like, they're, you know...
They're not evil guys. Yes. They just don't understand what they're doing.
And this is one of the central tentpoles of the kayfabe, is that all of this is a good-natured contest. All of this exists within the framework of free speech. All of this exists within the framework of the marketplace of ideas. We're bringing them back. I quite enjoyed these.
Licking the Overton window on the short bus of ideas.
Yes. Really, what you end up here is the two stalls.
I'm going to be like a Christmas bus attack at your marketplace of ideas.
That's terrible. You have to pick a stall.
Oh, yes, right. I see what you've done there now. So you've got to have like a Sam Harris or Brianna Wu.
Yeah. You can only pick one. You've got to get David Baddiel, or you can get what's his face, James Lindsay.
Oh, Constantin Kesson.
Yeah. These are the two things that you are.
You want allowed. Francis Foster or Bill Maher?
One of the things we've spoken about, and one of our most controversial, I think, opinions is our let's say lack of commitment to free speech.
Yes, I mean, God, I had a slight brief back and forth with Ed Dutton about this on Twitter the other day, and I'm slightly annoyed he didn't carry on responding, because I just wanted to see what his arguments were for the sake of having a go at it myself. Because I tend to find that really when it comes down to it, most people's arguments for why we should have free speech are pathetic.
Yeah, and
there are a lot of otherwise very clever people that we know or know of, and we appreciate elements of their work. But when they turn around and go, free speech, it's an embarrassment. It's that you've started creating some masterwork of art, and then the end piece of it looks like a crayon drawing by a 5-year-old.
Well, do remember that it is still Slopvember,
well,
guys.
You couldn't fill the trough up unless everyone was talking all at once now,
yeah,
could
you?
Yeah,
I was going to say, free speech is one of the ultimate tentpoles of sloppism.
Yes.
The idea that most people have something worthwhile to say. And as we've said, you know, there's also the Substack piece,
yes,
that it comes from as well, and also your Internet and its Consequences piece too. Yeah. But what you end up with is a din, it's just infinite noise. It's freedom of whom to say what.
Yes, and what's the point in speech that has no value? Maybe that's the thing with free speech, that the speech itself is free because it's valueless. If it wasn't free speech, there would be value to it because there might actually be a cost to it.
Yes. Well, the big point that you make and that we make, again, this is something that we've talked about before, is that free speech was in the 1960s a supposedly leftist idea. When they were insurgent, when they were the insurgent force.
When they were fighting against the hard paternalism of the old right.
Yes.
But it's all changed now because it's the left that have become paternalist and they're trying to tell us what to think.
It is, again, a reversal of ideas, but it makes you completely useless.
Yes.
If your commitment is to letting your enemy infinitely degrade you.
But I would go even one deeper than that. That when they were using free speech as their slogan, they did so knowing that there was an asymmetric aspect to this. That their speech, especially if their speech was to become important, had to come at the cost of someone else's ability to engage in political expression. Where do you get your platform from? Sorry, for. Where do you get your resources so that your political expression is worthwhile? They must become at the behest of someone else. Whereas the modern contemporary quote-unquote right-wing idea of free speech is that, well, we can all just say what we want anyway.
Oh, thank you, Forged in the Ashes, for the £3 for the Christmas Theakston Fund and the Nation of Israel.
Yes.
And of course, we must say that we do support unlimited free speech for the Nation of Israel and unlimited immigration.
Oh, it's the freest of speech.
The freest of speech. The freest of immigration.
Never late. Never blackpilled. Never
again. But the point was the crossing of the aisle, and if we go back to our kind of left right shorthand of what the signs in quotes look like currently, you have sat there free speech, and we talked about the enforcement of social norms. The swapping round of those,
yes,
over the past 20 years has been extremely important in keeping the right contained,
yes,
and keeping them away from ideas of things like paternalism, of the enforcement of social norms, of their own brand of, you know, top-down social engineering. Yet societal norms are all set top-down, guys.
Yeah.
It's you can't have a bottom-up set of social norms, and so if you're for unlimited free speech, you have no social norms. That's also one of the other things that we talk about, too. People do not think about this. They don't think about the ideas. It simply becomes sloganeering.
Well, one aspect of free speech as well is that it taps into that bottom-up mythos.
Yes.
They talk about the free speech of the individual, whereas really what we are and should be dealing with is the concerted and careful political expression of an organised minority. The individual who sits there and rants, irrespective of how true his rants may be, matters for nothing, because if you've got no object, if you have no end point or goal that you are trying to reach by engaging in that expression, then it's pointless. And as a pre-retort to anyone that might suggest it, waking up da normies or red-pilling dumbasses in the abstract sense is not an objective and realizable political goal.
No, and as, again, I'll move back to this, as we've talked about the pieces of, well, the managerialism that exist above party politics are the big pieces real that need to be tackled. These are the real challenges. These are the real, you know, first principle modes of thinking that have created the post-war world.
And I think as well, to be even more specific on the free speech thing, you could have a little addendum on the security state there about informational platforms.
Yes.
That left or right, who nowadays would question the principle of online activism? I mean, don't we want more people to be doing that all the time so that that din becomes ever more roaring and insufferable? The slop. My slop runneth over. My trough runneth over with slop.
I think when we talk about, you know, ideas and concepts, we talk about the fact they don't have power in the abstract, which is true.
Mm.
And we talk about the fact that, you know, knowing is not half the battle. That is also true. And a lot of it, I find these days, is keep calm and remember your training.
Yes.
It's what, well, a lot of people ask me, like, how did we call the stuff with, you know, the riots so well? How did we call the election? All of that. It really is, it's first principles. But a lot of you might think, well, I know that the left-right dipole isn't true. I know this, I know that. But it's a very, very small amount of people who would be willing to listen to, like, right-wing class analysis.
Mm.
There's a very small amount of people who wouldn't reflexively go, that's a leftist talking point, when something is quote-unquote left-coded that makes sense.
Yes.
Because there is a huge amount of prior programming here. You are not immune to propaganda, as Garfield will tell you. As Garfield will say, you are not immune to propaganda.
But there is almost like a Maoist struggle session element of this as well. If we were to talk maybe more specifically in this sort of framework about people who are consciously pushing right-wing ideas onto the left.
Yes.
They are engaging in this sort of struggle session with your fellow patriots and fellow conservatives about basically dumping the last vestiges of more totalitarian, paternalistic, forceful right-wing ideas and dumping them onto the left as bad historical baggage.
Well, we'll probably talk about this example when we talk about farming again, but I want to talk about friend-enemy distinction. This is classic friend-enemy distinction from the left.
Yes.
They are currently trying to demolish the last vestiges of the landowning class, which are the farmers, really.
Mm.
The old landed gentry didn't find it worth having land.
This piece talks about how it is a fantasy about land prices coming from farming prices, which is wrong. Land pricing comes from the fact that people want to buy homes, or people want to, sorry, build homes on your farm, and that's why your land is worth more than it would be as a farm.
Yes.
But this really is the friend-enemy distinction, to the point that you would willingly subject your people to hunger to remove a kulak class.
Yes.
That is what we're seeing. It's a slower, it's incrementalism, and talk about, you know, the dissolution of the country states here. And yes, it is true. The first inheritance tax was meant to do this. This is inheritance tax functioning as intended. But they are very willing to come out and say, you know, hoarding land, things like that. There's a very, very clear friend-enemy distinction here that is simply not possible. We accept this. We accept this as a matter of course, but it shouldn't be.
Well, because Mr. Will Hutton is not an evil socialist that wants to rid us of food security. He's a misguided progressive that actually wants the best for everyone. And I think it's got so far now that we have this dichotomy even existing within the right itself.
Yes.
I know you've got a clip of Farage that you want to get up at some point here. And I have to admit, I've not actually listened to this clip. I've only just seen it a million times on Twitter and ignored it.
Yeah.
But what we are seeing here is that this principle of social cohesion and assimilation are becoming principles on the right over and above the issue of immigration.
Yes.
Therefore, because law and order is so important and standing by the process is so important, you can't have mass deportations because that would disrupt the social cohesion, comrade.
Well, the issue here is him talking about the fact that reform will at some point need a Muslim base.
Yes.
Because that's just how democracy works.
And if people listen closely, they will remember all the way back about 6 months ago, if not a little bit further, we discussed the fact that in some ways, reform and some of these third parties are literally going to take the place of being managerial arbitration sort of groups between Muslims and Sikhs.
This is the necessary concession needed to live within the current mainstream. You know, this is supposed to be the far acceptable edge of the mainstream right.
Mm.
I'll just play this.
But the nub of it is, we have a Muslim population in Britain growing by about 75% every 10 years. Right? That's just where we are.
Mm-hmm.
If we politically alienate the whole of Islam, we will lose. We'll lose.
So how does one include
them? Will lose. By 2050, goodness knows what kind of a terrible state we're going to be in. But the nub of it is...
I decided to play again because I do. I love looping video.
Now we used to refer to Mike Stuckbury as like the disgraced former supply teacher.
Yeah.
Can we refer to Winston Marshall as the disgraced former pop star? Become broadcast, bro.
Possibly, but it's important the reason that he must admit, you know, abject defeat before the fight has even started, is because of the rules. It's because of the rules of play. It's because of this.
Mm.
It's because you cannot have a proper friend-enemy distinction, and his incrementalism and continuity is not capable of tackling the quote-unquote Muslim problem.
But have you noticed now that if we go back to the list you've got there?
Yeah.
Farage is rightly being attacked by people for saying this, but the people that are attacking him under these quote-unquote right-wing principles.
Yes.
He's being punched from the right for what he's saying about Islam here because it doesn't respect a sovereign individual.
Yeah.
It doesn't respect British law and order. It doesn't respect social cohesion, free speech, or Zionism, does it?
No. Yes, he's and what's happening here is that the attacks on, you know, quote unquote Islamism must come from this angle.
Mm.
There's no thread of they are not us, they shouldn't be here. It's all to do with value.
Yeah, when you see like some guy like David Atherton having a go at Farage for this, Atherton isn't having a go at him from the right. He's having a go at him from a more condensed and powerful neoconservative position.
Yes.
it's dare I say, an orthogonal step, not one to the right, as we would put it.
Well, Here we go. This is a little bit of Sam Francis's Beautiful Losers we've got here. It's one of the better sources we find for, well, for any of this.
Yes.
Sam Francis' writing has been excellent. We've reviewed this book. We've talked about this book before. And this is an excerpt from his essay about Dr. King, The Case for MLK. But this is really him elucidating some of the purpose of what we would consider the non-revolutionary right. Do you want to read this, Evelyn?
Yeah, I'll carry on and then... I get a bit dry, we can switch over. It's one thing to say that Dr. King was a great man and a great American, a man whose personal courage and vision, despite his human flaws, errors, and enthusiasms, challenged lesser men of both races and forced them to confront evils, falsehoods, and obsolete ways. It is quite another to say, as the US government does say in creating a legal public holiday for him, that Martin Luther King Jr. was the most important American who ever lived. At least the peer of George Washington, the father of this country, the only American in history to have his birthday made a national holiday, the man who is now first in the hearts of his countrymen. Conservatives, some of whom, like Representatives Jack Kemp and Newt Gingrich...
Still there.
voted for the King holiday in 1983, may devise whatever clever rationales for supporting it they can imagine, but the truth is that Mr. Harding's understanding of the meaning of King's career is far closer to the truth. And I'll have a brief intermission here before we get on to the rest of this, because the Mr. Harding in question, mentioned in this article previously, is one Vincent Harding, a Marxist professor of religion and social transformation. What Sam Francis is saying to us here is that no matter what individualist or abstract liberal principles that rhinos were using to justify MLK Day back then, it doesn't matter, because the hardcore argument and the people that really have something to stand and say for MLK were revolutionary communists. And this is the same problem with free speech. You might have all these rational, lovely arguments for it, but you are going to lose to someone who says, I need free speech because my group's oppressed and we're coming for you.
I'll tell you what I'll slide it in here, that what we do need, though, is a little bit of interaction on these videos.
Yes.
I'll say, I've not said it yet, that interacting with the videos, liking, commenting, doing all that for the Al Gore's rhythm, where you do like hearing about Al Gore's rhythm.
I love hearing about Al Gore's rhythm, how much people love Israel, whether or not they can get pints of Theakston's in their local, and how the weather is where you are.
Yes.
If you want to give me all of those in the list, you get bonus points and you get a little sticker or something.
Do you want to continue or should I?
Yes, and I'll carry on. In any case, aside from obligatory genuflections to King by neoconservatives, cultural conservatives, and the adherents of Mr. Gingrich's Conservative Opportunity Society, I know of not a single serious, sustained effort by those on the contemporary American right to substantiate their endorsement of the holiday, or of any serious argument why conservatives should honour Dr. King at all. I think like Churchill, maybe. Hmm?
Yeah, yeah. This is very Winston Churchill. And also it's very the modern non-identitarian right, let's say, that the anti-woke right is constantly invoking Martin Luther King in this way.
Yes.
This is Samuel Francis commenting on Ronald Reagan's administration making Martin Luther King Day a federal holiday. As he said, the second such American to be given a federal holiday after George Washington.
If there are valid reasons for why we should do so, we do not hear them. What we do hear are sermons from apostles such as Mr. Harding and company, most of whom can press a far more persuasive claim to King's legacy than conservatives of any description. That legacy, as its keepers know, is profoundly at odds with the historic American order, and that is why they can have no rest until the symbols of that order are pulled up, root and branch. To say that Dr. King and the cause he really represented are now part of the official American creed, indeed, the defining and dominant symbol of that creed, which is that both houses of the United States Congress said in 1983 and what President Ronald Reagan signed into law shortly afterwards, is the inauguration of a new order of the ages, in which the symbols of the old order and the things they symbolised can retain neither meaning nor respect. And this is again that point against incrementalism. There was no incremental love and support for Martin Luther King in this sort of situation we see here. It's that one day you go to sleep and the man is remembered as a degenerate communist militant. And then you wake up the next day and an American hero, Ronnie Reagan, is telling you, this is an American hero. And you're un-American if you don't like him.
Yes.
He stands for our values. Carry on the last bit here. In which they are as mute and dark as the gods of Babylon and Tyre, and from whose cold ashes will rise a new god, levelling their rough places, straightening their crookedness, and exalting every valley until the whole earth is flattened beneath his feet and perceives the glory of the new Lord. And there is a number of points in here about equality and egalitarianism I think we could talk about, but we've really done to death elsewhere.
Yes.
What interests me is this fundamentally. Liberal and centrist perspectives on history that carry a Marxist undertone have now persisted for so long that there is what we could only describe as a leakage of values, likely responsible for some of the inversions and stereotypes we see in the contemporary left and right as we listed above. And it's essentially this sort of own New Age Whiggism. And fundamentally, we must distinguish ourselves between that and what we believe.
Yes.
The involvement in any proper right-thinking political organisation of those carrying Marxist priors, maybe even unwillingly or unconsciously, is an organisation doomed to fail. Think of this maybe a slightly reworded version of a Sullivan's First Law.
Yes.
But the point being that this version of the right that we have on screen, this new right, this right of the contemporary, is unworkable and is always doomed to fall under its own priors. And I think part of the fact that some people are so confused why they're allowed to have their right-wing thinking emboldened, because these are the people picking up the tab at the end of the day.
Yes.
It's like a perfect mass psychological safety mechanism so that when any right-wing idea or momentum or sort of cultural fad picks up enough of anything, it's shut down by its own principles collapsing underneath it.
I would argue that both are unworkable.
Yes.
Both are deliberately unworkable. We talk about the managerial class, the elite class. We talk about those who actually operate institutions of power, who are deal makers. We don't talk about the left. We don't talk about the left as a mass, apart from when we talk about them in the abstract like this. When we talk about them as a construct, as a concept, as the left is described to us. The left, in quotes, is in a much worse state on a grassroots than the quote-unquote writers, because their ideas are unworkable all the way up until you hit the power politics stuff, which is really just placed there so anybody who has an interest in power politics has to subscribe to the most convoluted
and insane
set of ideas.
You've got to be pro-LGBTQ, yes, pro-Hamas, pro all these different groups that can't actually get on with one another, but because you've got a ironclad commitment to the ideas of equality and equity, you end up with constant arbitration. You can't do the Leninist or Stalinist thing of turning around and going, well, I'm sorry, comrade, but equality only goes so far.
Yeah, you can't kill your enemies because that would become inequitable.
Yes.
You need to figure out how to equitably kill your enemies.
And both, it's the one thing that both of these sides agree upon.
Yes.
If you kill your enemies, they win.
Yes, exactly. And it is an engine designed, as we always talk about, like the separation of powers. The modern left-right dialectic is meant to result in paralysis.
Mm.
Paralysis and one directional compromise towards a set of predetermined goals. You can always find the centrist answer to all of the questions, as I've said before, that is brought up by these points is the permanent agenda. It is the moving forward. It is the further management of society.
And I think this will even become more obvious in time as there is an attempt to essentially solve these dichotomies by the principles we've already mentioned that are always agreed upon.
Yes.
And I think it's going to become so obvious at some point to people like us that if you think it's tedious now, oh boy, yes. you've got so much still coming. I mean, we still, after a decade, I mean, how long is this? you've got the Murdoch, you know, yeah, the left of the real racist thing. I mean, how old is that clip at this point?
God, we're getting towards it being, it's not 10 years, but it's close. It's 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, so we, you know, a year ago,
the Democrats are the real racists.
No, God damn it, we are.
And we still have an inordinate amount of people running around pretending to be conservatives going, the left is the real racist. They're the real racist. They're not fair. They don't believe in merit.
This is also why, like, we don't play well with a lot of others.
No.
We have a very high standard because turning yourself into this weird parody of the left-right dipole is a great way to become entirely useless.
Well, yeah. What are you meant to do? We're meant to spend the rest of our time trying to talk Marxist priors out of people who hate us anyway. Yeah, that sounds like a great waste of time. And it also sounds like someone else in that consequence is winning.
Yes, it's also a great recipe to have those people turn around and call you the Marxist because you're talking about power and class.
Yes. I mean, I will say, as I've said for a very long time at this point, if none of this doesn't quite click to you, go away and just read Lenin and keep reading it and keep reading it. And eventually, at some point, all these things will slot into place and you go, oh, crap, it's not about ideas. It's about subjugating your enemies.
The whole, we talk about Lenin and people go, well, why are you for economic socialism? I'm like, well, Lenin didn't have anything really to say about economic socialism. He had a lot to say about hanging kulaks against his correspondences.
He had a lot to say about how he planned on achieving economic socialism, which became a much larger agenda encompassing the social programs and entire reshaping of a society all in one fell swoop.
People also completely conflate framings with ideas, with tactics, with power.
Yes.
They don't understand the differentiation between how power operates, how ideas operate, how framing operates, and quite simply how the human condition operates.
Yes, and we talked about it last week as part of the stream that we were doing, and we'll briefly mention it again, but this is part of what that whole woke right thing was about, was trying to get that sort of thinking seen to be uncool on the right, or the fact that you've got all these sort of BAP orbiters suggesting that you've got the smelly protesters at Columbia University, the anti-Semites. You want to be a cool patriot, don't you?
Again, I'll just put it back on screen. There we go. That's what you get. You get the Democrats, the real racists, and the left, the real anti-Semites. And that's all we ever really get. Like I said, if you do want to support us, do check out the Substack. There will be some stuff going up there. I know I say that every week, but there will be. I've just had endless trouble with it. Is there anything else we need to add before we go and end here?
No, I think we've covered our bases here, and I think, as usual, if anyone has any questions or additions or things that they think we've not quite covered here, do feel free to let us know. But obviously, first you have to tell me how much you enjoy Al Gore's rhythms and how much you love the Nation of Israel.
Yes. Anyway, I'll say a goodbye from me.
Good night.
Good night. You guys have a good one. Bye.